Hello, and welcome to the Alcohol Problem Podcast. I'm Dr. James Morris, an alcohol researcher interested in harmful drinking and addiction issues. This stems in part from my own experiences, so the show aims to explore a range of lived and academic perspectives relating to the question of what really is an alcohol problem. In this episode, I talked to Dr. Luke Mitchison and Dr. Mike Callagher about alcohol treatment. We discuss what the important components of alcohol treatment might look like, who it's for, and related issues like mental health and the importance of the individual in change processes. So thanks so much for joining me. Can I just briefly ask you to introduce yourselves and your roles, and then we'll get stuck in?
My name is Luke Mitchison. I'm a clinical psychologist and I work in a drug and alcohol service in South London. I'm also an advisor to Office for Health Inclusion and Disparities.
Health Improvement Disparities,
but obviously I'm speaking in a personal capacity.
And I'm Mike Kelleher. I'm a consultant addiction psychiatrist and working here with Luke in Lambeth as a clinician. Great to see you, James.
Great. Thanks so much for joining me. So, yeah, what I really wanted to kind of discuss was the idea of alcohol treatment. And you know, I think there's a lot of perceptions or maybe misperceptions about it as maybe just detox or residential rehab. But yeah, I think we want to kind of untap a bit some of the kind of nuances of it and explore the interface, particularly as well between kind of psychological or psychosocial based approaches, as well as the interface with the pharmacological side. So what would you say would be a really key few components of effective alcohol treatment?
Well, I guess lots of people might think alcohol treatment might be a detoxification and then a period of residential rehabilitation, and then people are sort of get on with their lives. And whilst those are obviously important components, I think, and obviously people shouldn't abruptly cease drinking if they are dependent upon alcohol, because that can be incredibly dangerous, and Mike will pick up on some of this, is I think we need to think about treatment in a broader sense. So essentially this is about someone trying to overcome an overlearned habit, which probably has had quite profound consequences for their own well-being, their physical well-being, their mental well-being, the people around them, their work, these kind of things. And so treatment needs to broadly look at helping someone change their behavior. And it's not just alcohol, same with all substances. So what someone might expect if they come to treatment, obviously the kind of medical workup, which Mike will talk to, but fundamentally speaking to someone who hopefully is experienced as supportive and helpful and kind, who can give someone a bit of clarity about where they need to go in their life and what they need to do it. And I would stress that coming to treatment's one thing, but actually it's putting all that stuff into practice in the community, in your day-to-day life, that is where the change really happens. Having clear goals, looking at developing alternative activities and hanging out with people who aren't going to be encouraging you to drink. That's the value of various mutual aid groups as a like-minded individuals who want to change a behavior and focusing on rewards and activities that aren't really about alcohol use. And I guess, you know, treatment can the psychological aspect of treatment can help people understand their triggers to drinking and how they might manage that differently, learn some coping strategies, and clarify whether abstinence is the appropriate goal or even a controlled drinking program. So that's a broad overview of treatment. Maybe Mike would speak about the medical aspects.
Yeah. Thanks, Luke. I mean, I think it's you've covered any hugely important thing to us, both of us here working in Lambeth, would be that treatment would be kind and open and accessible, and working in partnership with the patient of the service user rather than in a kind of paternalistic, kind of controlling fashion. And I think echoing something Luke has said, you know, you're helping a service user, a patient, work to their goals. I've never, ever seen anyone change alcohol use behavior when it's problematic, whether it's dependence, daily drinking or binge drinking, getting into trouble, without exerting some control and understanding of them as an independent agent. And we do, we will endeavor to treat patients where they are and what they, with what they want. I guess what I'm saying is, you know, there is no evidence. You can't coerce someone correctly in this country, in my view. You can't coerce someone around forcing them to accept alcohol treatment. People have to be willing to accept something in it. And we will work with people wherever they want to be in that. If they want to cut down, control their drinking, we'll work them all the way to those who want to abstain. Sometimes we'll make recommendations to them that actually, I think you're drinking too much, you need to abstain, the controlled drinking won't work for you and you'll end up in trouble if you keep doing it. But I can't force people to abstain. And if you disagree with me, it doesn't mean you're going to be discharged from treatment because you say, I don't want to abstain, I want to control my drinking. And then thinking more broadly about the medical things we do, immediately you got to think about how you can reduce the harm from alcohol that people are suffering, you know, and so whether everybody comes into treatment should have oral thiamine, and those who drink it very heavily and maybe not eating at all properly and maybe have some comorbid conditions, you might want to give them injections of parental thiamine, a multi-drug thing called Pabranex, and then working with them to keep a drink diary, control their drinking, see can they cut down the amount they're drinking, see can they reduce the amount of days they're drinking in the week. But if people are drinking daily, and if they do experience withdrawal effects, and the withdrawal effects from alcohol, they'll come in with it, if you're a dependent drinker, so your brain is physically changed, or your body is physically changed because of your alcohol use, they will experience effects like shaking, sweating, nausea, vomiting, anxiety, tachycardia, that's the heart beating fast, and hypertension, that's raised blood pressure as a consequence of alcohol withdrawal. And if it gets very severe, it can move into things like having seizures, that's overactivity of the brain, losing consciousness, shaking and fitting, and onto a thing called delirium tremens, where patients individually become psychotic, and that's a medical emergency. And so for people in that situation who are at risk of withdrawal, we would want detox. But generally speaking, a good treatment service should be looking where you are at, should do a full, decent medical assessment, our healthcare assessment, as well as the full psychological and social assessment, and work out what the necessary treatments are that we would recommend to you, but not exclude people who might be unwilling to do that or achieve that. So I guess that's a very brief overview, James.
I guess the thing that I'm really interested in is kind of, you know, the nature of alcohol problems as something which is difficult to, you know, draw lines in the sand. You know, there's no discrete categories between sort of necessarily dependence and non-dependence. But of course, people who engage in alcohol treatment tend to be higher severity alcohol problems and tend to have at least kind of moderate or more severe aspects of dependence. But there's also a lot of people who might experience degrees of alcohol dependence who might kind of go through natural recovery. So I guess, yeah, any thoughts on the kind of, I suppose it's the complex nature of alcohol problems and the difficulty in drawing lines between sort of physical and psychological aspects of it.
I mean, I guess perhaps we need to just take a step back and think about where alcohol sits in society. And I'm sure other podcasts cover this, but you know, it's part of our cultural tradition. And in a sense, our heritage, isn't it? That alcohol use is, you know, we learn to do it in our teen years, obviously accepting there are different kind of cultural, constraints, as well in the multicultural society we live in. But, you know, we learn in our teens and we are bombarded with, the idea that alcohol is a great sociable thing to be doing. And, you know, we have, you know, people don't set out to develop alcohol problems. They start drinking and enjoy it. And perhaps for some people, it is a way of, early, you know, in the early stages is a way of managing it, you know, emotional distress or, you know, existential angst or ennui. And then things can escalate. But I think people can sort of almost hide in plain sight in the culture and society we live in, and alcohol is available 24/7. So there's a context in which, you know, the all the right ingredients are there for a substance which has profound psychological, makes pretty quickly fixes in inverted commas difficult feelings. The availability sets the scene for problems to develop. And I think from a treatment perspective, we'd be very, we would encourage people to come to us before they develop a severe dependence. But that's accepting that, you know, that people can and many do, and most people probably change outside of treatment because they come to the realization their alcohol use becomes, it is incompatible fundamentally with who they want to see themselves as a person and how they want and how other people treat them, and life gets in the way, you know, hopefully with the right opportunities in life, people have education and employment opportunities, and actually drinking heavily and recovering from the after effects becomes incompatible with the things that give them a sense of meaning, purpose and direction. And what we try and do from a psychosocial perspective in treatment is to try and put back in perhaps some of those constraints that have been lost, because classic for any addiction is that loss of a valued role and a sort of narrowing of what we call narrowing of behavioral repertoire, you know, so everything becomes around the drinking rather than all the other things. So we try and, you know, try and support people to put some of those constraints back in. So connecting with other people, coming to groups, learning about how they might manage their behavior differently, supporting people to get back into work, these kind of things. So treatment should in a sense mirror what happens out there, what you termed natural recovery. No one really comes here without a sense of duress. Yeah, so that recognition that actually I can't carry on doing this anymore is causing me or other people's problems. But that's the grit that leads to the change. That realization, something's got to change. I don't know how to do it. But I've got to do something because I'm killing myself, or my wife's going to leave me, or I'm going to lose my job.
I think you make a really important point there about the societal normalization and, yeah, the kind of idea of alcohol problems in the societal view on the whole is one of a kind of severe caricature, a stereotype rooted around alcoholism and inverted commas. And that enables the kind of majority, and including many heavy drinkers, to kind of create this idea that their drinking is kind of okay. So it often does take, you know, more severe consequences, you know, relationship breakdown, and it's because of the drinking, or severe health problems. Those tend to be often, unfortunately, the markers when people, or triggers for people seeking help. Whereas I do think, exactly as you say, we need more interventions and more understanding about recovery or change processes, like further upstream where people maybe haven't developed such severe dependency.
I think, James, listening to yourself and Lou talking there, James, you know, I mean, kind of in a funny way, it often seems to me the most important part of treatment is actually that social, that psychological understanding of why you're drinking, how it's leading to your problems, what the consequences are, and getting some sort of grip on your own behavior, you know. Because when it comes to the kind of pharmacological interventions, in some ways they are quite straightforward, you know. Certainly when we look at detoxing someone, yes, you know, there are risks to detoxing someone if they need to have a detox to remove the physical signs and symptoms of withdrawal. There are risks to it, and sometimes we need to put people to an inpatient unit, some to the community. But it should be relatively straightforward. We start someone on they're assessed. They come in, they get breathalyzed to check they haven't drunk within the last certain number of hours, whatever the rules are for the particular clinic. And then you start them off on a reducing dose of a benzodiazepine. And most detox in the community take 5 to 7 days. Some people, those of severe physical ill health, severe uncontrolled mental ill health, or severe social isolation, or a history of seizures or delirium tremens in treated alcohol withdrawals, would have to go to a residential unit. But, you know, I think people often get fixated on that bit of alcohol treatment. And actually, you know, I can watch people coming back over and over and over again looking for a detox, but not understanding, you know, actually the problem isn't the need for me to remove the signs and symptoms of physical withdrawal. It's for the individual to understand, why am I drinking? How can I help myself not go back to this means of alcohol consumption? And I think that's something that often gets lost within the ideas of alcohol treatment. And of course, as you've talked, James, yes, many of the harms, the consequence harms of alcohol are associated with daily heavy drinking, such as liver disease. We know that alcohol is the huge, biggest driver, perhaps, in this country of alcohol, or fatal liver disease in this country, huge driver of liver transplants. So, yes, of course, that's true. And we know there's a big association with psychological health, anxiety, depression, and there's, as well as the social reasons, the psychological reasons why you may become anxious or depressed because you drink too much. Obviously, there's actually strong biological reasons why that will happen too. And perhaps with the greatest biological understanding of all of psychiatry of the links between alcohol and drugs and how it makes you mood and makes your anxiety. But there are also consequences which aren't related directly to being a daily dependent drinker. And if you look at violent incidents, so in a borough like Lambeth, I believe the place you're most likely to be a victim of a violent assault is Friday and Saturday night in Clapham High Street, one of the wealthiest parts of the borough. And that's a product of the amount of, that's the size of the nighttime economy, you know. We know that when it comes to people tragically committing suicide, we know a lot of them are intoxicated to the point of death, maybe a third. You know, the WHO will estimate that maybe 20-odd% of suicides are related to alcohol. But I think it's a minority of them that are in the alcohol dependent, and people do impulsive things when they're intoxicated. And so, it's understanding, you know, kind of, it's not just about that severe, the severe physical end of the spectrum. Of course, we want a treatment. Of course, we want to provide our correct treatments, our regulated treatments for these. But understand there's a wider group outside that. And understanding for both groups, both the non-daily drinkers and the daily drinkers, ultimately change in their behavior lies within. And that's in exploring through good psychological and social interventions. You can't just fixate on the medical interventions, I think, you know, which I think sometimes people have. It's not just about that. Ultimately, detox is easy. Pharmacological detox is easy. Staying sober is hard, if that's what you're aiming for. Controlling drinking is hard.
And you won't do it with willpower. You need to fundamentally make changes in your what you do every day and who you hang out with. And that's why we would always advocate for people to access mutual aid. And that would either be the 12-step groups, AA or Smart Recovery, which is a cognitive-based approach. It does, in a way, from my perspective, the important thing is connecting with other people who are trying to do the same thing as you and picking up those tips. That's what mutual aid is all about, really.
I'd agree with that, of course. But also the other thing I think mutual aid does is provide social connection. And to go, you know, back to the point that Mike made about the link with suicide and, you know, other mental health issues, I think it's the other really important aspect is the general coexistence of alcohol use and other mental health issues in the broader population. You know, certainly from my personal perspective, you know, my development of alcohol problems was heavily linked to the initial reward it felt in terms of alleviating anxiety, but in turn led to extreme sort of almost feelings of panic attacks or because of the kind of effects of the heavy drinking. But there is that really, you know, very in the momentary sort of benefit of the pharmacological effects, but it's the kind of knock-on consequences where it can make it worse and become a coping mechanism. So yeah, I'm really interested in, again, not the severe end, but how embedded other, you know, everyday, I mean, their labels still meant depression and anxiety are still labels, but they're a broad cluster of experiences that people feel that are very heavily embedded in alcohol problems across the spectrum.
Because, of course, because alcohol is a great social lubricant. And that's what, you know, it does, as you say, for everyone, it stops that background chatter and enables them to sort of get into the experience. You know, perhaps as you get older, you learn to live with your anxiety, accept that's part of who you are and manage your life accordingly. And as you say, see the totality of the experience. If you drink, there's going to be a consequence to it. Unfortunately, there's no such thing as consequence-free substance use, I would say. You just need to embrace the totality of it if that's what you're going to do, and do it more safely, obviously. The point clearly, there are people who have severe social anxiety, panic disorder, for whom they need to have access to the appropriate evidence-based interventions, which are fundamentally going to be a sort of cognitive behavioral approach. The same for depression. You know, to say to someone who has a severe social anxiety disorder, you just stop drinking and then we'll give you a treatment. after that. That's not going to happen. You need someone who can do a good assessment at the front end. Yes, if there's a need for some specialist alcohol treatment, deal with the medical side, yes, that should be available to them. But you need to pick them up quickly and give them the appropriate intervention, which will help them learn how to manage their those sort of self-attacking thoughts about how they perform in social situations. And equally, someone who's very depressed, you know, you need to be helping them to think about how they are able to activate themselves and find positive reinforcement in activities which hopefully aren't related to drinking. So you do need a mental health workforce that are aware of alcohol, but not in a way to exclude people from services, to in a sense to enhance their understanding of what's going on and tweak the treatment package accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, you raise a good point, James, and Luke has echoed it about kind of, you know, alcohol in the short term is a marvelous anxiolytic or, you know, antidepressant, you know, any. Works in part in the very same receptors that benzodiazepines do, and that'll cause mild euphoria, quite strong euphoria, but also remove anxiety and remove negative thoughts. And it's not surprising that people who have some of these underlying thoughts, that some of them will turn to alcohol as a means of solving them in the short term. Obviously, in the longer term, the brain adapts, because the brain always wants to be in balance. And it downregulates certain receptors, and other excitatory neurotransmitters, say glutamate, become more active to overcome. And you end up in a position where, you know, you have to drink more to get the same kind of positive effects that you were experiencing on mood. And the points where you're not drinking, your mood is in a terrible place. And I think people can start off that, you know, they can turn to alcohol as a means of solving such negative mood states, you know, and then it becomes seductive, and then it traps them in, and then it makes things worse. And as we're saying about the change to the GABA system and other brain systems, there are strong biological reasons for it, but obviously at the same time there's strong social reasons for it, because as you drink more regularly, people get into difficulties in their relationships, they get into difficulties at work, they may get into difficulties with the police and with wider healthcare, and there's a whole range of kind of exogenous or social reasons why for them to be anxious and kind of are depressed as it goes along. And actually, one of the funny things is, when you do detox someone who is physically dependent, you can improve the things on the biological reasons why things are bad for them, that the biological systems will adapt as you detox them, they come off. But unfortunately, the social problems they have, or the psychological problems they have, they don't go away. They're still there. And actually, unlike when you're still drinking, you know, like when you're still drinking, when you're sober, when you're not drinking at that point, you've controlled your drinking, you now have to confront these problems. And sometimes that can be very hard for people. And I think a lot of people struggle at that point and can end up leading people back to drinking again. So I think, you know, I think there is a strong link between them. You know, services, when it comes to treatment services, you get this idea that kind of people are saying, oh, no, the alcohol caused the depression. You know, the depression causes the alcohol, you know, kind of. You know, it's a fool's errand trying to work this out, I think, you know, kind of what people need to do is give the relevant treatments, you know, and if that relevant treatment is a manualized psychological intervention for anxiety, then that should be available to the person, provided they're not turning up intoxicated to the sessions.
Absolutely.
You know, and so, you know, I think those getting those kind of links, but there is a strong link between psychological distress and alcohol. Definitely.
There's a phrase in, I think it comes from the from AA or the 12 step. It's a solution that maintains the problem, which I think is a lovely, captures both aspects of it. You know, the fact that people might drink because it helps in the short term, but actually it then maintains the problems, keeps them in bed some. And you know, back to Mike's point, you know, the reason why willpower won't work is because all those other issues that need to be addressed, and you need other people to support you and work with people and have activities that fill your time in a way that gives you a sense of meaning, purpose, where you feel valued. And that takes time to build, and I hope good treatment should plug you into those support networks.
And I think that thing is a really difficult balance to find, isn't it? That you're not kind of, you're saying to someone, you have control here, but we're here to help you. exert that, you know, the, even making sense, because it can be very easy either to drop into kind of wagging your finger at people saying, why don't you just sober up on one hand, or on the other hand, just totally kind of folding in and saying, well, I'm going to do everything for you and I'm going to change this. And neither route is correct. There is this skill treatment, I think, is finding this middle course, which is accepting the autonomy of the individual, you know, and the free will and their capacity to change, but also recognizing that this is really hard and we're here to help. We're here to help that. And if it wasn't really hard, there wouldn't be so many people drinking so much in this country and damaging themselves and others around them, I suppose.
There's such an important point there around, yeah, I think in the kind of amongst the general public and, well, amongst everyone, there's some really complex, almost philosophical issues about trying to understand the nature of addiction, and the idea of kind of free will or choice gets dichotomously pitted against the idea of it being a disease as the sort of opposite. And yeah, Nick Heather did a paper about addiction. Is it a disease or choice? Answer, neither. And I think you touched on some of the really important complex interfaces between why, yeah, it's kind of neither and both, in a sense that that we know that people's beliefs about their capacity to recover are really important. And as people go through treatment or recovery, self-efficacy, their confidence in their belief to change and to exert, like in inverted commas, willpower, becomes generally stronger as people go through recovery. So, you know, I guess it's both a consequence of and an explicit goal of treatment is to kind of, yeah, facilitate or growth in confidence in that person to kind of, yeah, like exert choices or decisions that might be both below conscious awareness and above it in lots of different ways. And obviously having the right social networks and removing problematic triggers or kind of stressful situations are going to be really strong in kind of assisting people to avoid those situations or kind of manage them when they do occur. So I think, yeah, it's really, you know, we obviously don't want to go or much more into the kind of complexities of the nature of addiction, but I think that's really important to highlight in treatment, that it's about, exactly as you say, enabling someone to develop their own sense of autonomy and confidence in kind of making these changes that are difficult.
But isn't that fundamentally what all humans need in life, to find a credible story that helps explain their issues and where they're headed and where they're going, where they are, a way of making sense? And I'm not bothered if people want to talk about having a disease. I'm not bothered when they say it's fundamentally about that they have complete autonomy. So if they're using that story as a way to harness a sense of agency and a desire to make a change and to do proactive things in their community outside of treatment, it doesn't matter to me. It's fundamentally supporting people to make changes and to become the person they want to become. That's what treatment should be about.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think absolutely. There's a lot of debate about the terms and the concepts and so on. And yeah, they're important in some contexts, but ultimately if someone finds a certain sense-making process or, you know, a certain group or kind of set of language or terms that helps them, then absolutely, we've got to support that.
Yeah, and I keep talking about your story, because I think that's just the final part, I suppose, is, you know, treatment is going to be full of people with lived experience. The people you work with, the clinicians, the workers, or the recovery support workers, it's people with lived experience are going to be in those agencies. And I think and their stories are incredibly important in helping shape what treatment should look like and then working alongside where people are at.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, I think the reason I am so keen to talk about mine is just to challenge the idea that alcohol problems are always severe and that they only affect people who need treatment and have physical dependence, because I think the more we help people understand that there is no cutoff. There is, you know, many, many shades of grey, and Adrian Charles has obviously been a much more higher profile version of that. That's ultimately probably the best way to reduce stigma, because it breaks down the idea that there's two groups of people, and that's the basis of stigma, is outgrouping and labelling and discriminating against the outgroup.
I mean, that's a really important point, James. You know, kind of we other, all psychological distress we other, you know, yes, it's over there, it's other people. And diagnostic classifications like DSM and ICD create these nice ideas of discrete categories, you know, and even when you look at units of alcohols and audits, they create these ideas. And the reality is, you know, you only got to get drunk once and do something really foolish when you're intoxicated, you know, that you mightn't do when you're sober, you know, and kind of you've got difficulties. Now, that wouldn't reach caseness for a harmful use of alcohol or whatever DSM-5 is saying now, mild alcohol dependence. But, you know, you could be in hospital, you could be dead. And I think accepting that kind of, you know, there is a whole range of issues that people have with alcohol. And at the other end of the spectrum, you know, whenever people come, you know, I saw a chap this week, he wouldn't think of himself alcohol dependent, doesn't drink every day, you know, but having a few difficulties in the office. And drinking a little bit in the evening, 3 or 4 evenings a week, a bit too much, and he's finding the mood is quite negative the next day, and he's not up for it, you know, at work, and it's caused problems at work. And I generally say, one of the best things you can do in those situations is, you know, you might think of yourself as a dependent or have an alcohol problem, but just stop drinking, because you'll find your mood will hit a more level plane for you. You know, and I'm not saying you can never drink again. I'm not saying you can't control your drinking, but just when you're in this little bit of a crisis, you know, stepping away for it can be a good thing. And I think, I think understanding alcohol in a more nuanced way like that, like you're trying to do, James, I think that for me is a really, really positive thing, rather than creating, these are alcoholics, these people are over here, and everyone else is over the other side. I think that is unhelpful.
I think that's probably a really great note to kind of end on. So thank you both so much for joining me. I think that was a really brilliant, succinct discussion.
Thank you, James. So it was a pleasure talking to you, man.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Alcohol Problem Podcast. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram @AlcoholPodcast. So please feel free to follow us or get in touch there.